You're listening to 23 Jungle Tales, all on the Sports Objective. Between now and opening day, we will talk to 23 former Pirate baseball players about their path to East Carolina, their time in the purple and gold, and what they're up to now. Now let's talk Pirate baseball.
Welcome in to 23 Jungle Tales right here on the Sports Objective, another great episode. And by the way, before we get to our great guest, 23 Jungle Tales brought to you by PGXGloves.com. I want to thank Mark Minakazi, oh, good old Kaz, who played third base during the Randy Mazey era. I want to thank him so much for all that he's done for this show and for this particular show for 23 Jungle Tales. Of course, 23 former Pirates players or coaches. As we take a look back, getting ready for the season starting on February the 19th, and very excited about the 2021 campaign. But right now, we're going to take a memory down, take a trip down memory lane. But I want to remind you, PGXGlovesBubba.com, they've got everything.
Yeah, PGXGloves.com. Give Kaz and the folks at PGX Gloves an opportunity to provide you with your baseball gloves, whether it's a customized glove, you know, with different colors and other options that they have, and personalization with your name, message, whatever you want on it, then they can provide it for you. And then also, baseball stuff's not all they have. They have some sharp-looking swag, and we'll have that on the screen for you here in some of our upcoming shows. We'll do a screen share, and but definitely go to pgxgloves.com and check it out. They also have football and golf gloves as well.
And by the way, I talked to a former Pirate Club staff member, Austin Collard, the rep, and he's looking to get some gloves there from Kaz. He loved it. Checked out the website, pgxgloves.com. Appreciate Mark Minakazi and Bubba. Very excited now to have a great pitcher. Man, we've had a lot of great pitchers back in the day and present time.
Absolutely. And this guy pitched for the Pirates, as you see there on the screen. If you're viewing tonight, 1986 to 1990. I got it right on the other overlays. I'll have to correct that. But Tim Langdon, welcome into the show, Tim. Sorry about that.
Hey, you made me younger.
You look great for you. Like, that's a decade extra, right? You came right before I started at East Carolina. Very cool time. I always tell people, even though I didn't play for Coach O, Coach O was my coach as far as going to college there. He was the baseball coach. I always have a special place in my heart for him. And I know that Coach O is just a special person. I mean, he's still there at the university after all these years. I know he's a graduate of ECU. I mean, I can't think of many people that bleed more purple than gold than him, right?
I can't. I mean, he bleeds purple and gold, man. And he's a doctor too, I think, right? He's like Dr. Everett. Of course, I would never call him that. I call him Coach O, but I'm sure he appreciates all the hard work he put in to get to that part. But yeah, I had a great time playing baseball for Coach O when I was in Greenville. He's a great guy.
Talk about Tim, your recruitment. We hear some great stories, but talk about your recruitment to come to East Carolina. We're very excited and happy that you were a Pirate.
Yeah, I mean, so if you kind of have – I listened to Calvin Brown's Jungle Tale and Coach Best. I've watched theirs, and it's funny how their path – my path is similar to theirs. I know, you know, I didn't commit to ECU until late in my senior year. You know, quite honestly, I thought I was on the path to Raleigh, to NC State. I mean, I was from Clayton and played there, and Coach Tanner at NC State. You know, I had been to every home football game at State that year, courtesy of the pack and basketball games. And, you know, that's the path that I thought I was going to. I was going to be in Raleigh. And then, but I had also Coach O, you know, recruiting was a little different back then. I mean, they had a little more leeway. Like, I talked to Coach O. I mean, he would call. You know, it's weird. He would call my home, and, you know, I talked to him on the phone, and He'd check in periodically, and you know, it just, you know, so I went through my senior season thinking that's what the path that I was going. I was going to Raleigh to be, at state. And then my senior year, I was playing American Legion ball. And Coach O, I played for Johnston County in American Legion. And we were playing Lee County. And one of their shortstop at Lee County had committed to play at East Carolina. Eric Gupton was his name. And so Coach O came to my Legion game. I had no idea he was coming and saw me pitch. And I had a pretty good night that night. We won, and I ended up striking Eric out, I think his last at bat. We had a pretty epic battle that night for like a 12 or 13 pitch at bat. And like 2 days later, 3 days later, I get a phone call from Coach O, and he wanted me to come down to ECU for an official visit. And I'm like, okay, well, I hadn't signed yet or anything. I mean, sure, I'll come. And so I went to Greenville in, you know, I think it was late June or early July. It was in between American Legion baseball games. And Coach O, actually, I went with my girlfriend. And we went down, met Coach O, you know, went to dinner, showed us around campus. And Coach O said, you know, basically at dinner tonight, hey, we'd love for you to come to Greenville. And I verbally committed. I said, yeah, I'll do that. And so literally that was, I don't know, early to mid-July, somewhere in that time frame. I know it was hot. And, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 weeks later, I'm packed up in my car headed to Greenville to start my freshman year. So that's kind of the – and never looked Raleigh in the past and said, see you guys, your mistake. So I'm glad I made the choice that I made.
Tim, one question that it seems like just an observation here, the Jungle Tales we've had with Calvin and them, the you guys committed in the summertime, like literally right before, seems to be very late compared to these days. The kids, are committing a lot earlier.
It is. And, you know, it's so crazy. And that was – maybe that was the norm back in the day. You think about it, I don't remember, you know, because I played baseball as a freshman in high school, freshman, sophomore and such, and I don't remember anybody being – recruited or verbally committing as a freshman or a sophomore. And so I don't know, maybe the pattern, you know, obviously there's so many more kids playing and it's become such a year-round sport. And I guarantee you Coach Goblin has got his chart plotted out for 2023 and 2024 right now. 21 is obviously in the books, and I guarantee you so is probably 22. So it's just a change in that scheme of the way they recruit these kids now. They're verbal commitments, you know, if you ask that, you know, that coach has as much right to back out as that player does, but hey, it is, that's the way it is today. But yeah, that was more the norm back in the 80s and early 90s.
As far as the, you were talking about the recruitment, was there any kind of parties or anything you went to, or was it just definitely Coach O just saying, hey, I want you to come?
Well, no, for East Carolina, it was just, you know, it was, hey, we want you to come, we want you to play for us, and that kind of, but other, you know, it was no kind of party. It was kind of, I don't know, I'm trying to think of the right word to say. It was kind of boring, if you will, from a standpoint of there was no excitement. It's just, hey, we want you to come play, because it was that late in the season. Now, I had been on official recruit trips earlier in that year. I'd been to Carolina. I'd been to NC State. I'd been to Clemson. And I'd been to Appalachian State. So I had one recruit trip, official trip left, and it happened to be that I took it to ECU. And it was the most least exciting, or whatever the right term you want to use. But, you know, I ended up committing on that. That's the one I committed on.
Tim, I don't think you've referenced this. I had to step away for a moment, but obviously we've talked about Coach Gary Overton. Who was the pitching coach in those years?
Well, when I was there, so Coach Best really handled most of the hitting. Obviously, he handled all of the hitting duties. And quite honestly, you know, when I came on campus, Coach Overton really was the one. For the most part, now we also had you guys probably remember Jabbo Fulgham. he was our grad assistant, and he was a catcher at ECU. He played at ECU as well, so he helped with the pitchers as well. But between Coach Fulgham and Coach O, that's really who handled the pitching until my senior year. As you know, Coach Best. So in between the 89 season and my senior year, the 90 season, Coach Best took a position at Auburn to go be an assistant coach. So when we came back on campus for 90 for my senior year, we had Coach, it was it, Coach O was it. And so he was in the process. He had to hire another coach, and he ended up hiring a pitching coach, Kevin Anderson, who came in from George Mason and fulfilled those duties in the 90 season.
Yeah, I thought it was a little bit later on. I knew Roger Williams was at about 92, 93 or something. Yeah. He came in, and he, of course, if I'm unless I've missed him moving on, I think he's still at Louisville doing a heck of a job there.
Yeah, he is. And Roger, actually, Roger used to come when he got drafted. Roger would come out and work out with us in the preseason. It was actually kind of funny because, like, in the spring when we would get ready for the season, we had Roger out there working out with us. We had Butch Davis out there working with us. I mean, we had several minor leaguers that would come work. Coach O was very accommodating and letting those guys. Greg Briley, who was not an ECU guy, but he had played at he was a local guy. Was it North Pitt? He played high school ball there, and he ended up playing at Lewisburg College and NC State and got drafted. He was out there working out with us. So, I mean, it was a pretty interesting spring practices.
We have one of your former teammates, I guess teammates, not former teammates, but you know, chiming in, John White. He says lefty, and he says always, you know, glad to tune in. This is my teammate and a great man. Glad to listen.
Yeah, well, we call him Wool White because he had thick black hair. He was John was I mean, he couldn't even run his fingers through it. It was so thick, I'm sure. But we called him Wool White. So he was a good pitcher. Matter of fact, that 1990 team, it was me, it was JJ, and it was Wool. We were a rotation on the weekend. So we had a pretty good pitching staff that year. As far as, you know, starters, we had obviously we had other pitchers, but as far as doing the bulk of the starting.
Tim, one of the things that comes to mind is the stat that you always hear about of not making Omaha with a team to have the most NCAA appearances. But the way that I look at it is you guys are a perfect example of an amazing team. And we've had such a tradition through the years that that's the way you look at it is, I guess some people have a glass half full, a glass half empty. But for me, you guys, there's a lot of great players, teams in different areas. All the coaches have been, I think, really good over the years from way, way back, even way before my time.
Yeah, it's always been a tradition field program. I was looking last night, just kind of, you know, looking at some old stats best I can, and it's amazing how many, you know, you start in the 60s looking at the teams that came through and then into the 70s and 80s. It's just a rich tradition, man, and I'm just glad to be a part of it. I mean, you know, when I came in as a freshman, the 85 team, the 85-86 season team, that was a really, really good team too. The only problem was that was the year that Winford Johnson was a senior and Greg Hardison was a senior and Chris Bradbury Sarge was a senior. I mean, that was a very heavy junior and senior team. At that time, though, they only took, I think it was 48 teams to the tournament. They didn't take 64. And we lost in the championship game to Richmond and didn't make the NCAA tournament. But that team was really, really good as well. So, I mean, I got a chance to play on some really good teams through that stretch. But that 85-86 team and that 90 team really was a special team. So, you know, I'm proud to be a part of the Pirate baseball tradition.
Yeah, Tim, like you're saying, as far as the 48-team field, I guess that was up through maybe 97. And then in 98, when the super regional format, you know, sub-regional, super regional format was implemented, it moved from 48 to 64.
Yeah, and actually in the 1990 region, you're right, because back then you had eight regionals, eight winners went to the College World Series. That 1990 season, we were the number two seed in the Miami regional. So, I mean, if you look at it from that standpoint, I mean, that put us somewhere in the top 16 or 17, somewhere in that range when we finished our regular season and conference championships going into the NCAA playoffs. So, I mean, we were ranked pretty high as any team that had been at ECU at that point, up until that point.
Yeah. So you've talked about the pitching staff a little bit, and just talk about you individually arriving onto the scene there prior to the 86 season, fall of 85. You know, how did things go for you, and talk about when you saw your first real mound time?
So hindsight, when I first arrived on campus, you know, as most freshmen, you know, you've been very successful playing baseball, and you probably typically are one of the better players, if not the best player on the team. And I had played at Clayton High School, and I had played American Legion ball at Johnston County. So I stroll onto campus at ECU, you know, thinking, hey, this ain't going to be so tough. And then you get there, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, man, all these guys can play. And, you know, going into that fall practice, I'm like, man, this is awesome. And then after the fall season's over, you know, Coach O and I had conversation. He's like, you know, because I threw traditionally when I got to ECU, I threw more over top left-handed. I was a really over-the-top pitcher. And Coach O, in our fall meetings after this fall season's over, he said, I want to break your mechanics down completely and build you back up. And I'm like, what the heck are you talking about, man? These mechanics got me to East Carolina. And that was the thought process I had as a freshman. But, you know, my freshman year, but I said, okay, let's do it. You know, if it'll help me get on the mound, I'll do whatever you want me to do. So we did. And so, I dressed as a freshman in my freshman year, but really didn't see any mound time. I mean, it was such a heavy junior-senior pitching staff. And in the process, I was working on mechanics. Coach O was taking me from an over-the-top guy to more of a three-quarters, you know, like a shoulder-here type pitcher. The whole idea was to get more movement on my fastball and throw more strikes, which at the time I thought I did, but I really didn't. But that first year, you know, I didn't see a lot of playing time at all. And then my second year, we were as heavy with juniors that were now moved up to seniors. So my second year was a redshirt year for me. So quite honestly, after my first 2 years, I haven't been on the field. And I'm like, you know, as a matter of fact, I remember – and Coach O was still working with me on my mechanics, and it was a process to get through. Now that I look back at it now, and I'm like, if I hadn't have done that, I would have never seen the mound at East Carolina, because Coach O knew what he was doing. And he knew by getting me to consistently throw strikes, because, I mean, quite honestly, in college baseball, if you're not getting strikes, you're not going to be successful, whether you throw 80 or whether you throw 90.
I'm sorry. You brought up a great point. Sorry, I thought you were finished. You brought up a great point about the very fact of your first 2 years pretty much not on the mound. It's amazing, maybe it's because you and I are closer in age than the guys today, but just disappointed to see I'm talking about in general, not necessarily East Carolina, but the college athletes today are expecting that they start with their freshman year. They're expecting, like, instant gratification, instant success. And you're a perfect example. There's many guys like you, ladies like you, that have come and played college sports that we're in player development when you're in college. And that would, like you said, if you had started, you may not have had the success.
No, that's a good point, Dave. I mean, if I hadn't have done what Coach O asked me to done, I probably would have quit after my second year. Matter of fact, I never talked to Coach O about this, or never said anything to him. But when I went home for summer or spring, after the spring season, my second year, you know, I got home and I talked to my mom, and I'm like, I'm not going to do this anymore. Mom said, she said, do me a favor, go back one more time in the fall. If it doesn't work after the fall, then you can do it. I said, okay, I'll do that. So I went back for the fall, so that would have been my third year, my red shirt sophomore year, and it clicked. Everything that Coach Allen had been talking about, mechanics, my mechanics started, like, I mean, it became second nature to me. I was throwing strikes. I had movement on my fastball. I was throwing harder. And it's like the guy was like a, you know, a savant. I mean, I'm like, how did he know to do this to me? I mean, I you know, and my pitching time increased dramatically. I mean, I threw a lot more my that year, my third year. I came out of the pen a lot that year and pitched. And then the next 2 years, I was in the, you know, the weekend rotations. And actually, I say weekend rotations. I mean, we had weekend rotations, but I was pitching all the time. I threw a lot my last 2 years at ECU as far as out of the rotation.
Yeah, talk about some of those guys that you played with. I mean, you've referenced the pitching staff some, but I know in 1989, and yeah, it was against non-Division I opponents, but and it was 7-inning ball games, but still very impressive. And he was a tremendous pitcher against the better competition we played as well. You know, Jake Jacobs, he threw two no-hitters in a span of 6 days.
Yeah, so that year in 89, so it was Jake, it was Jonathan Jenkins, and it was me in the weekend rotation. And Jake, you say what you want to. If you throw a no-hitter, a no-hitter is a no-hitter. I don't
think. Absolutely.
kudos for doing that. I mean, you know, I threw several one-hitters and two-hitters. I'd never threw a no-hitter in all the baseball that I played from the time I was 6, 7, 8 years old through college into the minor leagues. And I played in the men's league after that for several years. I'd never throw a no-hitter. So that's a big-time accomplishment. Brian Berkman, I mean, he came in his freshman year. He threw one his freshman year. I'm like, my gosh, man. He comes in his freshman year, throws one. I've never thrown one. I mean, so.
Yeah, but
Jake was a good.
Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Jake was a really good pitcher. And, you know, anytime you can do that back-to-back, man. Or not back to back, but two times. I mean, I don't care if it's against D2 or D1. It's a big deal.
Yeah, and I noticed the one that you were referencing as well. I'm trying to remember who it was against. I think it was maybe St. Bonaventure or somebody. But
yeah, it was early in the season, and we had a history of playing early in the season. We were everybody came to Greenville and played baseball. We were always home on spring break my first 4 years. So it was probably St. Bonaventure or Fairfield. Or somebody like that, or Ohio University. It was somebody that came out of the Northeast.
That's pretty crazy to have three no hitters in the span of 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
Tim, talk about that very thing. You were talking about the pitching staff, and certainly, what were the, can you talk about your pitches? How many pitches, different kind of pitches, did you have?
So, I threw. You know, once we got my mechanics squared away, and it was second nature, I threw a fastball, but my fastball had a lot of movement on it. So I threw mostly fastballs, but I threw a lot of fastballs. I threw a curveball, and I learned to throw a change. Although when Tommy Easton got there in, I think Tommy came in 88, he's like, man, you need to learn to throw a slider. And so those last 2 years, me and Tommy worked on it. I threw fastball, slider, and curveball, and really didn't really throw a changeup. So, but those were the fastball, slider, and curveball were really the three pitches that I could throw and throw strikes really well.
You created a nice transition for me, Tim. I was going to ask next about Tommy Easton. Talk about Tommy. I know he was a tremendous catcher, and he could really swing the bat. But tell us about what Tommy Easton was like, you know, when you guys were throwing your bullpens, and whether it was practice or when he may come out during the game onto the mound.
So I would have to say Tommy came in as a freshman. He was a highly touted freshman, even though he came from Snow Hill. Busting on him about being from Snow Hill. But even though he came in, he was a highly touted. And one thing that Tommy and I did, we got on the same page early on in his career, because when he came in 88, so he immediately became the starting catcher. I mean, Chris, we had a couple of guys that called. Chris Caldwell was there as well, and they split some time. But for the most part, Tommy did the bulk of the catching. And he was a very, you know, people think of him as he's a really good hitter as well. Don't get me wrong. He can swing the bat. But he was as good a catcher as he was a hitter. I mean, he had a great arm, but he knew how to call a game. And so I found that as we, the more we threw each other over that season of 88 and 1990, we kind of got on the same page to kind of sync. And you can tell when you're on the same page and when you're synced with a catcher, because you don't do a lot of shaking. When you're shaking off a catcher, you guys are out of rhythm. And Tommy knew he knew what I wanted to throw, and I knew what he wanted me to throw. So it was pretty cool.
You brought up that name, Chris Cobble. Chris Cobble is now the head coach at Carson High School, which is about 3 miles from me.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. What? I know he was from, was it Catawba County or Rowan? I can't remember which one it is.
Probably Rowan, because that's where I am now. I'm in China Grove, the home of Eric Tyler. I'm sure, you know, you remember that name from just a few seasons ago.
Yep. But Rowan County, Cobble was a good guy too. He was a good catcher. He was, but he played a lot. You know, Chris, when he wasn't catching, he would DH a lot. So I mean, we had that 1988-89 team. That was a really good team too, but that 90 team was the team that gelled into the, you know, one of the best teams to ever play or come together there in Greenville.
And, Tim, you brought up with Tommy Eason, what a great job he did, of course, at East Carolina. And now he's done a nice job at Pitt for the Bulldogs, building the program at Pitt Community College.
He has. And, you know, I think about that from time to time. I'm like, he has done such a good job of building that program there in Greenville at Pitt Community. And you don't think about it, but I mean, he's been to a couple of College World Series. I mean, that program is a powerhouse now. I used to think about in the JUCOs in the state of North Carolina, South Carolina, Lewisburg, you know, Junior College was like, that was the powerhouse. And Tommy's turned Pitt Community College into the powerhouse as far as JUCOs go in the North Carolina ranks.
Yeah, it's hard to believe he's been there in like 16 or 17 years now, because the last time he was at East Carolina was on Randy Mazey's staff in 2005 before he was let go.
Funny story, the last time I saw Tommy was a couple of years ago. I was at Emerald Isle, and I was sitting on the beach in a sun chair in my bathing suit, sitting there just chilling out, watching the waves and stuff. And these two little girls come up to me on the beach. They were young. And they're like, our daddy wants to talk to you. And I'm like, I was kind of freaked out on my order. These two girls walking up to me. And I turned and looked, and there was Tommy, and he was laughing his butt off. And he's like, what's up?
That was a pretty good impersonation there. you sounded like Tommy.
I didn't have a dip in, though. If I'd had some Copenhagen in my mouth, I'd have sounded just like him.
Yeah, I think I told you this when we spoke on the phone, you know, setting this up. And Tommy and his wife, Mary Beth, they have their seats in Section 15 at Dowdy Ficklin. They sit near us.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I've seen him at a few football games, too. I think the last football game I saw him at was Letter Winter Weekend. I went down for a few, couple, 3 years back, and I saw Tommy and Mary Beth that weekend as well.
Hey, Bubba, I thought you were going to say that you shared a luge box at Telmbank Tower with Tommy.
Yeah, you know you're going to find Tommy Eason in a luge box. No, Tommy's like myself. He wants to be out with the crowd, and like Tim said, he had his, you know, Copenhagen or whatever he was dipping.
Oh man, it was funny because I can remember because I dipped it as well and chewed some, and I got pictures of me with chew in my mouth, but I would always look down at the plate getting signals from Tommy, and I'd always see his jaw just like, you know, popped out. You know, you see him every now and again pop his lid up and spit it out, and pretty normal.
Talk about some so people that maybe are not familiar with your era of baseball, players. Is there any stories? I know there's a lot of stories you can't share, but are there some really cool moments you can share with behind the scenes, maybe that the average Pirate fan and Pirate Nation wouldn't know?
Pr- probably, I'm trying to think from games. Of course, Bubba, you and I talked about the Greenville game, the Chapel Hill game in Greenville in 1990. That was pretty, that was a fun game. That was the night the Stricker was born. So the story, I don't know if everybody would know the story. So 1990, we're playing Chapel Hill. We're playing Carolina in Greenville. I actually pitched that game. And you guys know because you went there, but the way the outfield and at that time, there was a space in between the left field fence going down to the foul pole and then all the way across center, you had all those pine trees. And all the fans were tucked in because the stands were already full. Well, we had a rugby team at East Carolina, and the captain of the rugby team was a guy named Bob Eason. Well, that just happened to be Tommy's big brother. And Tommy had the rugby guys out in left field. Bob had all the rugby guys, and they're out there having a good time and had Guns N' Roses jamming Welcome to the Jungle. It's pretty interesting. And so it actually ended up turning up to be a really good ball game. We were up 2-1 going into the ninth inning. And I got pulled in the ninth. J.J. Jonathan Jenkins came in for me in the ninth. And they had a runner on third with two outs. And it was their leadoff hitter did a little bunt thing. It was a bang-bang play at first base. And the umpire rung him up, game over. And Coach Roberts from Carolina came out, and he was livid. Well, by that time, the rugby guys, there was a freshman rugby guy that was with them, and they had stripped him down completely naked and thrown his clothes over the left field fence. And so all of a sudden you see this body coming over the fence in left field, no clothes on. He was coming to get his clothes. And about the time he picks up all his clothes, he bends over toward the – I'm sure he didn't mean to. And about that time, Coach Roberts looks up and sees a naked butt in left field. And he looked at Coach O and pointed his finger at him. He said, "Gary, that's why I'm never coming back to Chapel Hill is because of that." And the crowd went crazy. And, I mean, it was probably the most memorable game I remember at ECU as far as – interaction with the fans, and plus we beat Carolina 2-1 that night, so it was a great game.
And then the rematch in Chapel Hill, it really was in the Pirates' favor, 8-1. We hit a grand slam, Steve Godden, early in that ball game, and you know, back in those days, you had to wait and get the result in the newspaper unless you had somebody that you were going to talk to on the phone in Greenville or whoever had been to the ball game, and that wasn't the case. So we found out the result, but we had no idea of everything you just described. So we found out when we went to the rematch in Chapel Hill, and Coach Roberts was running from the first base dugout and around to Coach Third, and all these Carolina fans in attendance that afternoon started chanting "Street."
Well, the not told story about that game is we were missing a couple of players that night. So we left Greenville. I can't remember if it was a Tuesday night or Wednesday night, but we were headed to Chapel Hill to play them. And it was about a week later. I mean, it was literally like a week apart or a week and a half apart. So we had some players that had some downtown Greenville fun on Saturday night and had caused a little issues. I won't go into great detail about that, but anyway, Coach O got a phone call on Monday morning, and the only way we knew about it, because when we got to the field house to go to Chapel Hill, I mean, you know, we always went, we went dressed and we would change over there. Usually we would go in, you know, dress clothes. And when we got to the Scales field house that day to go in and get ready, their uniforms were not in the locker. And all of a sudden, we hear so-and-so, 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 can y'all come into my office? And all we hear is yelling. And next thing you know, we see them walking out the door like, "See ya." And so we went to Greenville with our three starters. And so I remember me and Brian Burtman standing in the dugout looking at each other going, "Man, how's this going to play out?" And lo and behold, Steve Godden hits grand slam in the first inning, the top of the first. And, I mean, we go on to beat him again that week, and it was just like, "Oh my God, I can't believe this is happening." We, you know, a week and a half apart.
Yeah, like you're saying, we put up, I think it was 6 runs in the first inning or so. Yeah. And it was a funny story. A couple of Chapel Hill fans in front of my dad and I, and they looked at each other and said, this could get ugly.
And about time, if I remember correctly, about the time God hit that home run into first, there was a big crowd that had come in from Greenville that had bust in from ECU. And they were coming in the gates. I don't know if you've ever been to Bostromer Stadium, but it's a pretty stadium. And they were coming in, ECU yelling Pirates, and about the time when God hit home run. So it was mayhem in the first inning in Chapel Hill. And I'm like, my gosh, man, I didn't expect this today.
Yeah. It was certainly a day to remember for Pirate Nation.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a fun week and a half.
No question. Anytime you can beat the Tar Heels, it's a great day. And I know that the big picture, though, is it is great to have the in-state rivalries with NC State and North Carolina, Tim. But our program, even going back to your days and way before my age group and your age group back, like you were talking about, the baseball team has been known for so long. It's really a national program, not to take away from the in-state rivalries. But in other words, that's not our – everybody says that's our Super Bowl, but it's really not our Super Bowl when you think about – we want to go to Omaha. We want to win a national championship. That would be our Super Bowl.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the focus has changed now when you're starting. I mean, and, you know, quite honestly, with the pandemic that happened last year, I mean, they were on the verge of having, it felt like a really, really strong team again, possibly this year as well. So the whole thought process has changed. And now we're looking more national, looking towards Omaha, you know, so the games against the in-state rivalries, you know, UNCW, you could throw them in there because, you know, I didn't like playing UNCW. I disliked them just as much as I did Chapel Hill and you know, playing Raleigh, you know, NC State. But that focus and change now has become, hey, let's win our conference. Let's get a host a regional, host a super regional and get to Omaha. That's the focus now. And so, you know, I'm hoping that, yeah, if that happens, I want to be in Omaha, you know, pulling for the Pirates.
Yeah, what you said about last year's team is definitely true because, you know, early on the pitching and the defense was really, really good. And the bats, you know, were kind of hit or miss. But when things got shut down, the offense was really hitting its stride. And so it had been a lot of fun to see how things would have panned out the way we were clicking in all three phases of the game.
Yeah.
You were talking about Omaha. How many guys do you think will I think there's going to be – it may be several hundred former baseball players that will be at the College World Series. And I know Bubba and I will be there one way or another. Right, Bubba? I'll ride on the top of the car, Bubba, for the Rosenbaum vehicle if I can, if I have to.
You know, if we're allowed to be there, you know, yeah, we'll probably go this year, and I hope we do. If the Pirates are there, or whether I can be there or not, then that will be great. But yeah, if I can be there, then you know I'll be there.
I'll be like Aunt Edna. You can put me on the top of the station wagon, and y'all can tie me down.
The family truck.
Exactly. Hey, if that's what I have to do to get to the College World Series, as much as I love the Pirates and you guys, Tim, it's going to be special for you guys because a lot of great players have come through, like we talked about. One thing I wanted to ask you, and we'll get you a pro career, but I guess it goes back to the coaching staff and the recruiting the talent. But another thing I'm proud about the East Carolina tradition as far as baseball is how many players have been drafted over the years. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I know that 90 team that I'm trying to think from the time I was there from 85 to 90, 86 to 90, how many players got drafted and you know, head coach Best and coach Davis, you had some guys in the early 80s, Bob Patterson, who ended up playing in the big leagues. I mean, he may be the first Pirate in the big leagues. Not sure about that, but he's pretty close, I think. It has just gradually increased over the years. I know my senior year, we had 5 guys that got drafted off that team. And then the next year, Tommy Eason and I think Mike Whitten got drafted that next year too. It was either next year or the year after. So, I mean, it's incredible now. I mean, you know, and I like to think that I was a part of helping pave the way for those guys that come along now and have, you know, kind of put in the, you know, we all put in the work, but I mean, we kind of put in some work to help those guys that where they're at now. And yeah, it's pretty cool.
You already shared one tremendous jungle tale on that 1990 Chapel Hill game. And were there any others that stood out, you know, maybe a game against NC State or UNC Wilmington or whoever?
So I'm trying to think. Nothing on the scale of that Chapel Hill game. I mean, you couldn't write that any better. I mean, Mike Roberts was an ornery, ill guy anyway, the coach for the Tar Heels. So anytime you can get under his skin, it was easy to get him riled up. I mean, we had some pretty epic battles with UNCW, not like anything they've had in the past few years. I mean, they've turned that into a raging battle between them now, but we used to trounce UNCW pretty regular. We did, you know, my senior year, we played, what, nine or 10 games against ACC. And we lost two. We lost to State in the regional in Miami, and we lost to UVA at UVA and won everything else. So we held our own that year against them. I'm trying to think other games that were – you know, the one game – well, the conference – in 1989, the conference championship game, the way that ended, that was pretty spectacular. So we went to the UNCW. The tournament was at Wilmington that year in 1989. We went in as the number one seed. We lost the first game against William & Mary. We weren't supposed to lose to William & Mary. So we went into the loser's bracket, and we played all the way through the loser bracket. And we won, and we had to beat Richmond twice on Monday to get the championship, get the bid. So we won the first game, and then the second game became the do or die game. So that game, I'm trying to remember who pitched that game. Brian Berkman, he came in relief for me against George Mason that the game prior to the first Richmond game, and pitched like three innings. And then he started the Richmond game, pitched the whole game. We won. And so, I mean, he had an epic pitching series of like three or four games there in that tournament where he put in an unbelievable pitching performance. But we were tied. So we went to the final game against Richmond, and we were tied going into the ninth inning. Ninth inning ended. And I think it was like 2-2, 3-3. It was like, I mean, obviously we were tied. We were going to extra innings. And it was like 11 o'clock at night on Monday night. And a thunderstorm came up, completely, you know, raining cats and dogs. So they called the game. We had to come back Tuesday morning to finish the game there at UNCW. We started the game, I can't remember, I think it was the 10th inning. Neither team scored. The 11th inning, Richmond got runners on third base, had two outs, and their hitter hit a ball, a bullet down the left field, down the third base line. John Gass does his best Cal Ripken and lays out and snags the ball going over to third base. It looks like something you would see on, you know, MLB highlights, you know, with Vin Scully calling it. And the runner, obviously, from third, he's gone. He's taken off, I mean. And he pops up on his knees and makes a throw to Tommy and throws the guy out at the plate, ending up, you know, ends there in Richmond. If that ball pops up over the bag, game's over, they win. And we ended up scoring a run in the bottom of that inning and won the championship that day. So it was a pretty, you know, it was a pretty awesome way to end that 1989 championship game. And then the next year, 90, was a totally different story. We went to UNC Wilmington and we destroyed four teams in a row. So, I mean, it was a tell of two cities, but both earned championships that night or those 2 years.
In that 1990 season, when you were second team All-American by the ABCA, the American Baseball Coaches Association, just talk about, I think, well, you were 11-2, if I'm not mistaken, something like that. But out of those 11 wins, is there one that really stood out?
I'm trying to think. I mean, yeah, that season, that 90 season, yeah, I was either 11-2 or 12-2. I'll have to admit, I mean, it was a phenomenal year for the team, and I had a really good, personally had a good year there as well. The game against Chapel Hill was a game that I really enjoyed pitching against, but probably the game that I pitched the best all season long is what, you know, I've always told kids that I played, you know, in coaching baseball and stuff, and Coach O used to say this all the time, 20% of the time you've got your best stuff. 20% of the time you're awful. You couldn't get anybody out. And then there's the other 60% of the time where you live. That's where you really live, and you pitch and you grind and you eke out wins. Well, we played Western Carolina. That's the first time we played Western Carolina in Greenville in that 1990 season. And Jack Leggett was the head coach of that team, and we beat them twice that year. And if I'm not mistaken, Keith LeClaire was the grad assistant on that team as well. And so, but that first game against Western Carolina that day, that's probably the best game that I threw all season. I mean, I could have closed my eyes and thrown strikes. I mean, it felt, you know, I think I struck out 11 or 12 that day. I mean, it was just, as far as having my best stuff, I mean, I had other good games, but that's the day where it was like magic.
And Tim, some people have like a rhythm and, you know, the command, obviously on the mound. Were you a guy that took a lot of time, or did you want to go ahead and get there back on the mound and throw, like you're saying, throw darts?
Dude, you could tell if I was pitching and we won, it was a 2-hour and 20-minute game. I mean, I got the ball and I threw it. I mean, if I was involved and as far as pitching goes, and it was a 3-hour-plus contest, I got beat. So, yeah, I definitely wanted to get the ball, go.
So, in other words, the earlier you could get a shower, the better.
Exactly. Places to go.
You want to get definitely get back to Greenville. You had a party to go to.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Tim, take us back there after that 1990 season. Talk about the draft. You know, I know you were chosen by the Cleveland Indians. Tell us about that. You gave me a little information when we were setting this up as far as your, you know, signing bonus. If you want to mention that, I had to laugh when you threw in that about Shoney's.
So we finished the season. We go to Miami, and we finished the season. We fly back, and the draft happened. We got back from Miami on Monday night, and the draft started on Tuesday. Well, obviously, I wasn't going to be called on the first day. I mean, the next day, I knew that wasn't going to happen, so I really wasn't expecting anything. But, you know, through that year, Coach Anderson, man, he had really helped me a lot as far as, you know, and not just pitching, but also my thought process. I think I became a much better and mentally tougher pitcher. Anyway, so I had an idea that I was going to get drafted. I just didn't know. I thought I was going to get drafted by the Seattle Mariners because I know they had seen me pitch and come to see me pitch several times. And so I think it was Wednesday or Thursday of that week. My roommate Bertman called me. I was over at my girlfriend's house. He said, "Hey, dude," he said, "some guy just called here looking for you. Said he was with, it was a scout. He said he wanted to talk to you. He said he wanted to know if he calls you at this number, would you be okay?" I said, "Yeah, that's fine." So about 10 minutes later, I get a phone call from Paul Tunnell. He's the scout for the Cleveland Indians. And he said, "Hey, we took you in the draft." I'm like, "Cleveland?" I mean, I said it probably, and he's like, "Yeah, I know we suck, but, you know." But I was just shocked because I'm thinking, okay, the Seattle Mariners are going to call my name. But it wasn't. It was Cleveland. So he said, "Hey, I want to get together, want to talk to you about this, want to sign," that kind of thing. I said, "Okay, that's fine with me." I mean, I was a senior, so I'm like, what am I going to negotiate, whatever. So he said, "Are you familiar with Memorial?" I said, "Yeah, yeah." He said, "There's a Shoney's over there." I said, "Yeah, I know what you're talking about." He said, "Can we meet there for lunch tomorrow, say like 1 o'clock? I said, "Yeah, that's fine with me." So I meet the scout at a Shoney's for lunch. he didn't ask me about a signing bonus. He said, we can give you $2,000 and I'll buy your lunch today. And I thought, that's great. Where do I sign? When do I sign? And where am I going? He said, well, when you sign this right here, he said, I'm going to get you a ticket for Cleveland and you're on the way Sunday afternoon. I'm like, okay. So, I mean, I literally got drafted on Wednesday or Thursday. And on Sunday afternoon, I was flying out of RDU going to Cleveland because back in the day, Cleveland, they brought all their draft picks to Cleveland for a week's worth to kind of see what they had and where they were going to go and, you know, get the big league experience. Of course, it was Municipal Stadium at the time. It wasn't Jacobs Field or Progressive Field now like it is. So, but it was still, you know, you're 21 or you're 22 year old. I mean, that was a fun experience.
Hey, the team plane that they used in Major League, did they bring that down to get you?
It wasn't quite that bad. I flew American up there, but that would have been the icing on the cake if that thing had rolled up and Jabu had popped out or something.
get to be teammate for Pedro Serrano like John Gaston.
Yeah. I'd have been the dude brought up, hey, Joe Boone needs a refill, Barkey.
So talk about your let's talk about your pro career. Talk about that as something that, Bubba and I love baseball, and he's a huge Atlanta Braves fan, so he probably wished that you had been signed by the Braves. But talk about your career in the pros.
Well, I mean, I ended up going to play. I only played a couple of years. I mean, you know, I soon found out that the minor league baseball life is a tough life. I mean, no pun intended. I mean, it's a grind, man. I mean, 140 game season. I mean, and my first year, you know, I went to short season. When I got drafted, after we left Cleveland, I ended up going to Winter Haven, Florida. I don't know if you've ever been to Winter Haven, Florida in June and July, but it's hot. And I had a good success there and moved from there and went to Watertown, New York. So I went from Winter Haven, Florida to 50 miles from the Canadian border in Watertown, New York. So quite a contrast there, but had a pretty good, decent first year. Then went to spring training the next year. Thought I was going to be going to Columbus, Georgia to the A team, the lower A team. That was the whole, you know, thought process. And I ended up making the Kinston squad out of spring training. So I come from Tucson, fly back with the team to Kinston. Had no idea that I was going to be in Kinston. I mean, I lived in Greenville. So, I mean, I was commuting back and forth from Greenville to Kinston, you know, that first couple of months or so of that season. And it was quite an experience. Quite honestly, you know, ECU used to have the games where they played the Indians in an exhibition every year. And I played in one as a Pirate several times, and I got to play in one as an Indian against my Pirates. So, you know, I pitched that year that I got drafted, so that would have been, what, 91? I pitched against East Carolina. I pitched two innings against East Carolina in Greenville at Granger Stadium. So that was kind of surreal, if you will.
You give Tommy Eason some chin music?
You know, I didn't face Eason. I'm trying to think the guys that I did face. I struck a few of them out. I gave up one hit in two innings. I don't remember who got the hit.
That certainly would be embarrassing. Thinking about East Carolina, you kind of have something extra special. Did you throw harder or did you?
Yeah,
you want to make sure you did really well against your Pirates, right?
Yeah, matter of fact, Kevin Anderson was still pitching coach then. And after the game was over, he's like, man, you like you're throwing the ball harder than last year. I said, yeah. I said, of course, I've run my butt off for the past, you know, five. I was in spring training for like 4 or 5 weeks, and I mean, spring training in Arizona, it's fun. We had a good time, but man, it's work. I mean, it's not for the. I mean, you're not out there just, putzing around. I mean, you're actually working. So,
yeah, take us back. During those years,
And did you cross paths during spring training? Like, talk about some of the bigger name players in the Indians organization that you cross paths with.
So I don't know how familiar. So Jim Thome obviously was in the Indians organization at that time. He and I were not on the same team, but one of my roommates. Here's a weird thing. My roommate in spring training was a guy named Scott Morgan. Now that name doesn't mean anything to you and I. But it will if you remember Kirk Morgan, who pitched at East Carolina and played infield. So that's Kirk's dad. So Scott and I were roommates. We played pro ball together in the Indians organization, and his kid ends up becoming a Pirate and coming to East Carolina. So that was kind of cool. But, yeah, my roommate who I actually lived with during the season was a guy named Dave Maliki. So Dave, you know, he's kind of a – not so famous. He played in the big leagues. Dave played for – he made it to the big leagues with the Mets. He got traded from Cleveland to the Mets. He is famous for – or I think he's famous for – that was just when they started interleague play in what – I think it was 2000. The first Subway Series game between the Yankees and the Mets, Dave Maliki won that game for the Mets. So – and I still stay in touch. Dave ended up going from the Mets to the Tigers, and the Tigers was where he really had a good major league career. I mean, he won some games with the Tigers and made a ton of money. I made a bunch of money, and as far as I know, he hit a lick much since then after he retired. But I played with several of those guys. So Maliki was he was a big leaguer. I played with another guy named Robert Person, who ended up pitching for the Phillies and the Blue Jays in the big leagues. A name that you might remember the most, he was our right fielder when my first year in pro ball, was a guy named Brian Giles. And so Brian played in the big leagues with the Indians, and then he played for the San Diego Padres for a long time. And his brother, Bubba Marcus, played for the Braves for a right good while.
Yeah, you mentioned that name, Jim Thome. Obviously, there in the early 90s, after the Indians had been so bad, just like my Braves had been, they started figuring it out. You mentioned Jacobs Field earlier. I remember that came along not too long after Camden Yards, and they had those new uniforms, and they started putting it all together.
If you'd have seen Jim Thome, my first spring training in Tucson, Arizona. So, like, if you've seen the movie Major League, the facility that they work out at, the Corbett Field, that's in Tucson. That's where the movie was filmed, and that's where we spring trained at when I was with the Indians. And Thome, I mean, if you saw him in person, like, you'd see him in the hotel. I mean, he was 6'3". I mean, he's a good-sized guy. I mean, he was like, you know, I don't know. He looked like he was 195 pounds soaking wet, and compared to the guy that you see, you know, slugging 50 home runs for the Indians later on, and then going to Philadelphia and having the, you know, Jim Thome's in the Hall of Fame. You don't realize he hit 500 home runs, 600 home runs. I mean, that's insane to have a career like that.
No question about it. That puts you. Those kind of numbers will put you in the Hall of Fame, right, Tim?
Yeah.
It better anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
As far as where did you finish your pro career? Can you talk about that?
So I made the Kinston team, and that's where I made the Kinston team, and then that was the end. That was the end of my career. I mean, I did 2 years, and that's where I ended it, and you know, moved on to life and got out of the baseball game. Well, I moved into a different avenue of the baseball game. I started playing later on when I was in my 30s. I played in the men's league here in Raleigh, which was fun, but it was, you know, there's a lot of difference in playing baseball when you're 32, 3, 4, 5 versus 20, 21. Body doesn't do the same things as well as it used to, but it was fun. And then I kind of transitioned into – I've been several years helped a guy coach a travel team into Triangle called Purpose-Driven Baseball.
How about – you were talking about your 20s and 30s. How about your arm? How did it hold up in your 30s versus 20s? I know that's a lot you hear about guys with their pitchers with their with injuries to their arm?
You know, thank the Lord, I never really had any arm injuries whatsoever. I mean, well, I played that men's league from the time I was probably 33 or 4 range till I was 40. And thankfully, you only play like once a week, usually a Sunday afternoons, maybe a Saturday game. But when I turned 40, I had to stop. I mean, my arm, you wake up on Monday mornings, man, and it was agony. I mean, it takes days to get back to normal. And I'm like, I'm not doing this anymore. I've done enough baseball.
So what can you tell fans, what are you up to now since you put the ball down and left it on the mound?
So when I finished up with Kinston, we moved. I had gotten married in between seasons, the first minor league season and the second season. And so we moved to Raleigh. I ended up getting into the, on a whim, I got into car business. I started working for Leith. I was working at the BMW Mercedes store. And I was in the automotive industry for the bulk of my career. I mean, I've done that for 20 plus years and got out of it and kind of did my own thing. That's when I started doing some coaching and I moved to Tennessee. I actually lived in Nashville, Tennessee for 5 years from 2010 to 2015, working at the Mercedes-Benz store. I was a sales manager at the Mercedes store in Nashville. And then we moved back from Nashville to North Carolina just to get back home. I miss being in Central North Carolina and Johnston County. I tell everybody I moved back for the hot dogs and the barbecue because you can't get Carolina Packers in Nashville. And you certainly can't get good barbecue there, not like you can Eastern North Carolina.
Do you like Snoopy?
Yeah, I do like Snoopy's. I mean, I'm a fan of the Carolina Packers, but I like Snoopy's. I mean, it's different.
Yeah, I like Snoopy's in Raleigh. So I thought next time I go through Raleigh, I'll definitely go to Snoopy's. I hadn't thought about Snoopy's in a while.
Yeah, it's good. And so when we moved back, I told my wife, it's like, if I can stay out of the car business, the car business is great. I did it for 20 plus years and I really enjoyed it. But I had kind of burned out. So now I work for Curtis Media Group now. I'm in advertising sales with radio sales. So I sell radio for 94.7, our country station here in Raleigh, and 96.1 BBB, and we got several radio stations that I rep here locally for Curtis Media Group.
How about that? I worked. I'm an alum of Curtis Media. I worked there from 2010 to 2015, so I must have.
Really?
Yeah, I did. I worked for WPTF 680.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you know exactly where I go then.
I do. I love that. I miss the parking lot. I used to walk. Whenever I would be stressed out, I used to walk around that parking lot to kind of calm down a little bit.
It's a funny how many people I see. I'm like, what's going on in their brain? Because I see them out there doing that loop around out in Highwoods in the parking lot. I know what they're doing. But yeah, I enjoy working there, man. I've been working there now for three years or plus, and I really enjoy. I love that I'm still in sales and it's that competitive realm, but. I've actually got weekends now. I don't, when I was in the car business, I didn't. I worked every Saturday at the dealership. I was always at the dealership. So it's kind of nice now. I can see my kids and, they're grown now. I mean, they're 23 and 25, but I get to see them in more frequent nature now.
No question. Mike and Janie are tremendous people.
Yeah.
I think a lot of you have an easier sell when you have great people like them.
Mike and Janie, man, they're good people, and actually the whole group. I mean, it's good. Mr. Curtis is still there every day. 80 years old, going at it. Every Tuesday morning.
I hope I can live to 80. That man is like still going strong, and speaking of inspirations. That he's one of the best, and he was very, very good to me and gave me a job in July of 15. And the only reason why I left Curtis is to move back home to the house I'm living in now. It was, I did it for about 4 months, an hour and a half each way. It was very rough.
Yeah, that's tough.
I would still be at Curtis now if it wasn't for the commute every day. Like that was rough.
That's good to know. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, no doubt. So give everybody my best.
I will.
I'm with you, no doubt. And very happy for you that you're back in the area. And certainly we want you to I know that you follow the program closely, but I tell you, there's not going to be a greater feeling than to see this team. I know it's only a matter of it's not if, it's when, with Cliff going to Omaha. And like Bubba said, if they go this year, I'll be upset that I couldn't go, but I'll be happy that the monkey's finally off the back.
Yeah, no, it's sooner rather than later now, I think. I mean, it's they've got the pieces and the culture in place now, and it's just the key is getting ranked early and often. Like, you know, if you look how Carolina did it, you know, they showed the path to do it, get ranked high, go to a super regional and win, and set yourself up the next year and get ranked higher. It's all about being host. It's all about hosting regionals and super regionals. Your odds go up, I should say. I think they do.
Tremendously. Very rarely are you going to do what we did in 2016, where you go into Charlottesville and then nearly go into Lubbock and do the same thing.
Yeah, that's extremely hard to do. I mean, not that it hasn't happened and hasn't been done, but most of the time there's a reason those teams are hosting. And the home field does play into advantage. It'd be interesting to see what this year is going to look like.
Yeah, I mean, you look at our five super regionals. The only one that has been hosted by us was, of course, in 2001 when Tennessee came to Granger Stadium. The other ones we had to go to Columbia, and then that was in 2004. And then 2009, we had to go to Chapel Hill when they had a stacked pitching staff.
That was a stacked team they had.
And then 2016, we went to Lubbock, and then, of course, 2 years ago in 2019, we went to Louisville, and they were playing about as well as they could play. And then, you know, NCAA did us no favors. So we had the last regional to end, and then we played the first super regional.
Yeah. You know, Dave, you were asking about one of the most memorable times. I know it wasn't when I played in Greenville, but the night I was at the game, the night ECU played South Carolina, I was in the stands with Tom Moy and Brian Burtman, who both played there, when Devin Hester hit the home run against South Carolina in the bottom of the ninth to tie it up to go nine. Well, I think it was like 6-6 or 9-9.
Yeah, 9-9. Devin Harris.
That's it. That was one of the most incredible feelings. I remember watching that ball go out of the stadium. I'm like, oh my God, he has killed that ball. And I remember standing like, man, I cannot believe I'm standing here watching this. This is one of the most phenomenal things I've ever seen as a Pirate.
Yep. We trailed 9-6 going into the ninth. Yeah. And like you said, they threw that slider to Devin Harris, and he put it out there in the Jungle parking lot. It was – I would have loved to know how far that ball traveled.
It was a long way.
He had the game-winning hit.
He did.
10th inning to score Kyle Roller.
Yeah, he about took that pitcher's head off when he hit that ball back through the middle.
Some of those balls end up in the parking lot. What was Stratford Arms, the apartment complex, is still the parking lot where I park now for football games. But that, I know there's some massive shots over Charles Boulevard, right?
Exactly. Look, my freshman year, Chris Bradbury, they called him Sarge. He hit one in the tournament because the tournament was in Greenville that year. That may have been the first year of the CAA, and he hit one over in Stratford Arms. I mean, it was that far when it went out. I mean, it was insane. It went across Charles Boulevard.
Wow. They talk about a rocket. That's definitely a rocket for people that know that where that stadium, doesn't matter if it's Harrington or now Clark LeClaire. That's got to be, is that over 500 feet,
guys? It's close to it, I guarantee you.
Yeah. Wow. I haven't had the tape measure out, but it's way up there, more than I've ever hit one. I can say I've never hit a home run, so it just to hit a home run would be a big deal for me. But Tim, appreciate you so much for coming on. You've come on, and I looked at the time; it's well over in an hour. We could talk baseball anytime. In fact, we'd love to have you back on. We have extra innings coming where we can break down the game, and hopefully, we can be talking about a lot of Pirate victories this year. I feel like we will be. I think we're stacked to be obviously a regional team, maybe a super regional team. But love to have you back, and don't be a stranger. Appreciate it, the conversation, the visit tonight. It was nice to meet you.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed meeting you guys, and talking Pirate baseball with you guys. I really did enjoy the conversation. I didn't know what to expect when I first jumped on, but you guys made it super easy and kind of taking the level. I mean, I was a touch nervous, and you guys made me extremely, you know, at ease here. So it's been really fun talking to you guys about this.
Appreciate it. And we like to think of it, you know, just not so much an interview, just a conversation.
Yeah, it really is. That's what it turned out to be, more of a conversation.
And that's what it's all about. Appreciate it, buddy. Thank you very much. Man. And look forward to great success for your Curtis Media, and same thing for on the diamond for the Pirates this year.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks to Tim Langdon there. Appreciate him very much. Man, Bubba, that was a lot of fun. That's what 23 Jungle Tales is all about, is look back at great players like Tim. He was fantastic, a great guy, and still obviously doing very well for himself and Raleigh at Curtis Media. Hey, I tip my hat to him. You don't realize, Bubba, how hard sales are to begin with, but in that market, it's extremely hard. You talk about, speaking of major leagues, if you can make it in sales at Curtis Media and in the Raleigh market, you're really doing something. So he's a major leaguer in my book when it comes to sales, even now in 2021. By the way, Bubba, I want to remind fans, 23 Jungle Tales is brought to you by pgxgloves.com. pgxgloves.com. Bubba, very excited because I saw my email. I told you that they shipped out my t-shirts. I have the 23 Jungle Tales. If you're watching live now or an archive on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter, if you see the 23 Jungle Tales logo, that he has, Mark Minakazi actually made a 23 Jungle Tales t-shirt. I bought that one, a double X. And the kids, if you see the bottom left corner of the screen, they love Mark's PGX Gloves logo, the lion. So they both got a lion t-shirt. It's what they wanted. So they told me how much they love the lion photo, Bubba, the logo, I should say. And so that's on the way. I'm excited. I've been checking. Hey, Bubba, I'm so bad. It's like Christmas Day. I've been checking the front door every day for that package.
Yeah, no doubt. And just one moment, I was doing a screen share here. And we'll take a look at some of the swag we were talking about, as well as the gloves, batting gloves, golf gloves, football gloves, you name it. Bear with me one moment here. I'll scroll through. There's the Pirate collection that we've referenced, a sharp looking logo that you were just talking about, Dave. And, he has it in East Carolina colors, as you see there. So tremendous looking shirt. And then he also has it in graphite heather as well as purple. So
great stuff there. Great, great quality. I tell you what, you can look at the website. Austin Collard, that used to be with the Pirate Club, he's going to get some golf gloves. Bubba, by the way, he told me, and I told him to make sure, by the way, folks, if you're listening or watching this, make sure that in the promo code, East Carolina, you want to put capital ECU, capitals ECU, make sure they're capitals, and you'll get 25% off your order. And the great thing about it, hey, there's travel ball. Look at those gloves, man, those custom glove, baseball gloves. Just think about your kid right now. They're getting ready for maybe my son, hopefully, will be getting ready for a farm league. We haven't heard yet. And my daughter for softball. And wouldn't it be great to have one of those cool gloves, especially my daughter? She would love to have that because of the lion on the glove. But they have the cool batting gloves. My son loves batting gloves. I think Riley does too, Bubba's son. But certainly the PGX, Mark Minakazi, they just pop, you know. You want to stand out in a good way. And certainly with Primal PGX gloves, man, they just really, really do us right. And I appreciate their support of the program. And it's Pirates supporting Pirates. Cause was, of course, for those of you probably watching or listening, you know he was a third baseman during Randy Macy. We had him on last year on, I believe it was a 23 Jungle Tales last year, Bubba? I believe so.
I think we just had him on a normal podcast. But
okay. All right. But we'll certainly
have Cause back on here soon.
No doubt, and appreciate him so much. And again, folks, if you're looking for some cool swag, you're looking for some cool stuff, just go to pgxgloves.com. And again, in the promo code, put capital ECU for 25% off. It's a great deal, and very excited to be a part of the family now. The PGX family, and they're part of the obviously the Sports Objective family. So again, go to pgxgloves.com. Bubba, very excited. And do you want to make the announcement? Our other announcement?
I will. Just give me one moment here.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, folks, again, make sure that you get those orders in. I know that they do a great job of getting those orders and get them to you, getting those in a matter of days. So appreciate Mark Minakazi for his hard work on that. And we have a new sponsor, Next Level Training Center. Bubba, very excited to have a local Greenville, North Carolina business. As you see on the Where Players Train, I took my son, Trent Britt, took him to my son Alexander on his birthday, him and Mackenzie last year, March 20th. And I remember the date very well. My son was just over the moon that he was at Next Level Training Center. I think highly of those folks there. They do an excellent job. Bubba, you know, if Bubba were in Greenville, he would, the Greenville area, he would take his son, Riley, as well. It's a little bit of a commute, like what, Bubba, 3.5 hours, but proud to have Next Level Training Center as another sponsor of the show. People are getting the word out that this podcast is no joke. And when it comes to 23 Jungle Tales, when it comes to extra innings, right?
Yeah, with extra innings, each Sunday we'll take a look back at that week's games. You know, it'll be at least 4 games, assuming you don't have cancellations due to rainouts or COVID. But however many games the Pirates play that week, we'll take a look back. And then, you know, also, you know, take a look forward to whatever the Pirates have ahead of them the following week. But extra innings this year will be presented by Next Level Training Center. And then also we'll have, you know, play of the game or play of the week. And the play of the game and week will be brought to you by PGX Glove.
No doubt. Thanks to Mark Minakazi. Thanks to Trip Brett. Everybody at the Next Level Training Center and PGX Gloves. We have obviously a lot of good people, and this the best is yet to come. Bubba, thank you so much for your hard work. I know that a lot of hard work goes behind the scenes for getting the different players or coaches for 23 Jungle Tales. So very excited about we've got about 16 more, don't we, coming up?
That is correct.
So we'll have 16 more. So between now and the 19th and maybe a little bit beyond, we'll have more 23 Jungle Tales again. Brought to you by pgxgloves.com. Go there, buy something. And again, the promo code ECU and you save 25%. Make sure there's a capitals ECU as well. All right. For Tim Langdon and, of course, Bubba Rosenbaum, I'm Dave Richmond. You've been watching and listening to 23 Jungle Tales right here on the Sports Objective. And as always, go Pirates.
You've been listening to 23 Jungle Tales on the Sports Objective, the unofficial podcast of the Pirates. All these interviews and our other content can be seen on our Facebook page and YouTube channel. Be sure to like, follow, and subscribe. The audio can be heard anywhere you listen to our show, including but not limited to Google Podcasts, TuneIn Radio, SoundCloud, and Apple Podcasts. Follow us on social media on Twitter at TheSportsOBJ, on Instagram at The Sports Objective. Like and follow us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. As always, we appreciate you listening to the show. Go Pirates!